Hello, I'm Eric Huang. You're listening to Saint Podcast, a podcast about the always fascinating and often controversial lives of the saints. This is a history and culture podcast that traces the origins of the morality tales of the saints, also known as hagiographies, and how they continue to impact life today. We're now more than halfway through our ongoing series dedicated to martyrs, saints who died as a result of their beliefs. Over the remaining episodes, we'll hear about a queen who bested the brightest minds of the Roman Empire, the patron saint of music, a saint who was over 7.5 feet tall, and more. Episode 6 is about a saint whose name means little bear. She's a British saint, a princess from Britannia, the name of the British Isles when England and Wales were part of the Roman Empire. Her legend is based around a pilgrimage that included an entourage of 11,000 virgins, as well as an additional 15,000 hangers-on. They met their end in modern-day Germany and inspired a monastic order of nuns whose French chapter in Loudun was scandalized by demonic possessions and a witch trial. This is the story of Saint Ursula, the leader of 11,000 virgins. Like many of the saints we've discussed so far, Saint Ursula is a popular saint whose feast day was removed from the general Roman calendar when it was revised in 1969. When a saint is removed from the calendar, they're still a saint. The removal, however, is still a demotion of sorts. It means the global church no longer celebrates the saint's feast day, although local communities are permitted to and continue to do so. Sometimes it's a matter of convenience, a sign of the changing times as well. Many anachronistic saints have been removed to make the calendar more inclusive. In the case of Saint Ursula, like Saints Margaret and to a lesser degree Barbara, the demotion is due to lack of historical evidence that the figure ever existed at all. The Catholic Encyclopedia, an official church publication from 1912, has this to say about Ursula.
This legend, with its countless variants and increasingly fabulous developments, would fill more than 100 pages. Various characteristics of it were already regarded with suspicion by certain medieval writers, and have been universally rejected.
Nevertheless, the legend of Saint Ursula is a fascinating one, and continues to inspire both believers and non-believers alike. According to the Golden Legend, Ursula is a 4th to 7th century princess, the daughter of a Christian Romano-British king named Notus, or Maurus. We'll refer to him as Maurus. The King of Anglia hears of Ursula's wisdom and beauty, and wishes to arrange a marriage between his son, Prince Aetherius, and Princess Ursula. Ursula's father, King Maurus, sees the political benefits of this alliance, but he can't bear to give his daughter to the heretical pagan. Being wise, Ursula persuades her father to go ahead with the arranged marriage with certain conditions, a rider of sorts.
The first grace I ask is this, that he and the queen and their son, my spouse, be baptized in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. The second grace is that 3 years may be given me before the bridal, in which to go to and fro upon the sea, that I may visit the bodies of the saints in Rome and the blessed places of the Holy Land. And for the last grace, I ask that he choose 10 fair maidens of his kingdom, and with each of these 1,000 more, all of gentle blood, who shall come to me here in Britannia and go with me in gladness upon the sea, following this, my holy pilgrimage.
The previous passage is from The Story of St. Ursula, a short work by the artist and writer John Ruskin from around 1880. In this piece, Ursula asks for 3 things, graces as she calls them, before she'll consent to marry Prince Aetherius. 1. Her future husband, the Prince of Anglia, would be baptized and instructed in the Christian faith. 2. She'd be given 3 years to prepare herself for her wedding night, the night she'll lose her virginity. The 3 years would also include a pilgrimage to Rome and then to the Holy Land. 3. King Maurus and the King of Anglia would find 10 virgins to be her handmaidens. Plus, to her and to each of her 10 virgin companions, they would procure the service of an additional 1,000 virgins to accompany all of them to Rome. That's a total of 11,010 virgins, 11,011 if you count Ursula herself. Both kings agree to all the conditions, and the work begins to find the 10 virgins and their 1,000 attendants. When Ursula's fiancé converts to Christianity, he insists that his father also convert, to which the king agrees. The 11,010 virgins also convert to Christianity under the tutelage of Ursula herself. A company of men is then added to the entourage, soldiers, hunters, craftsmen, who are needed to keep the pilgrims alive and in comfort on the long journey. And there are animals too, pets, pack animals, and food. News of a British princess and her impending pilgrimage to Rome with thousands of attendants spreads across the empire. Bishops and princes from far and wide arrive in Britannia to join the band. The Golden Legend mentions a few by name, including Saint Gerasena, the Queen of Sicily, whose husband was a tyrant that she was able to pacify into a meek lamb. She arrives with her 4 daughters and toddler son in tow. Pantelis, Bishop of Basel in Switzerland, is mentioned. He is the legendary first Bishop of Basel, though there's no historical evidence for this figure or for Queen Gerasena of Sicily. Ursula's mother also joins the group, along with her daughters, Ursula's sisters, Babila, Juliana, Victoria, Aurea, and Ursula's brother, Adrian. The Golden Legend describes the preparations for the journey.
Then the queen showed her counsel to the knights of her company, and made them all to swear this new chivalry, and then began they to make various plays and games of battle, as to run here and there, and feigned many manner of plays, and for all that they left not their purpose, and sometimes they returned from this play at midday, and sometimes unneath at evensong time. And the barons and great lords assembled them to see the fair games and disports, and all had joy and pleasure in beholding them, and also marvel.
Ursula personally oversees the arrangements, converting all the newly arrived men to Christianity, which the Golden Legend calls this new chivalry. The preparations are like a military campaign, with spectators arriving to watch the exercises. By now, Ursula's entourage is larger than the size of many armies, with thousands joining the original 11,010 virgins. According to the Golden Legend, the party swells to over 26,000 by the time they end their journey and die in Cologne. It's a sunny day with favorable winds that seize off the pilgrims. They miraculously reach Thiel in one day, a port in Gaul, likely in modern-day Belgium. After a few more days of smooth sailing down the Rhine, they reach Cologne in Germany. It's here that Ursula learns of her fate. An angel visits her bedchamber with instructions that Ursula and her entourage are to leave their boats and travel first to Basel in Switzerland, then proceed to Rome on foot. In Rome, the angel continues, Ursula will meet the Pope, then lead the entourage back to Cologne, where they will all die. Ursula is overjoyed by the news. She's happy that she'll die gloriously for her Christian God. So in the morning, she leads her entourage to Basel, then to Rome as instructed, without any incident, eager to meet her fate to die as a martyr. Pope Cyriacus, who is also from Britannia, welcomes Ursula and her entourage when they arrive in Rome. The previous night, he too had a vision of the group's foretold death in Cologne. Wishing to die with Ursula, he declares he's joining the party on their trip back to Rome. Given that Cyriacus is Pope, however, he can't simply leave Rome and his work. So he assembles the papal court and resigns on the spot. The cardinals and bishops think him insane, but their attempts to dissuade him are in vain. There's no mention of a Pope Cyriacus in any historical records. His reign would have been somewhere between Pope Felix II and Pope Damasus, but there are no mentions of a Pope Cyriacus except in the Golden Legend, which also provides an explanation for this absence. The pope who succeeds Cyriacus according to the Golden Legend is named Pope Ametos. He is also not an attested figure. Allegedly, Pope Ametos struck Cyriacus' name from all records because he abandoned his office. At any rate, Ursula, her 11,000 virgins, 10 virgin companions, likely fictional Pope Cyriacus, and thousands of others, spend a few nights in Rome. As they take in the holy sites of the Eternal City, more and more people join them, including additional, likely fictional, clerics and royals inspired by visions of a glorious death. Ursula's presence isn't celebrated by everyone. Two pagan commanders in the Roman army, Maximus and Africanus, are wary of Ursula's popularity and her ever-growing following. They send word to a man named Julian or Julius, a leader of the Huns, a nomadic people of Central Asia who were fierce warriors and a constant thorn in the sides of big empires like Persia and Rome. They tell Julius about this group of now 26,000 people who are easy prey, richly furnished with food and valuables, on their way to Cologne. Meanwhile, back in Britannia, Ursula's fiancé, Prince Aetherius, has an angelic vision himself. Following the angel's instructions, he baptizes his mother and sister Florentina, and all join Ursula in Cologne, accompanied by a local bishop named Clement. When they arrive in Cologne, the city is under siege. The Golden Legend describes the melee.
When the Huns saw them, they began to run upon them with a great cry, and raged like wolves on sheep, and slew all this great multitude. And when they were all beheaded, they came to the blessed Ursula, and the prince of them, seeing her beauty so marvellous, was abashed, and began to comfort her upon the death of the virgins, and promised to her to take her to his wife. And when she had refused him and despised him at all, he shot at her an arrow and pierced her through the body, and so accomplished martyrdom.
As prophesied, Julius and his band of ferocious Huns intercepts Ursula and her retinue in Cologne. Everyone in Ursula's entourage is beheaded, all 26,000 plus people. Ursula herself is killed by Julius, who shoots her with an arrow after she refuses to marry him. In some versions of the story, it's Attila the Hun himself who kills her. This has no historic basis. There's a side story about one of the virgins, Corjula, the only one named by the Golden Legend, although all 11,000 have subsequently been given names. Corjula, which means little heart, is said to have hid all night in her ship, escaping the slaughter. Come morning, however, she comes to her senses and surrenders to be beheaded. Ursula's feast day, the 21st of October, remembers the entire entourage except for Corjula, who survived them by one day. Corjula's feast day is on the 22nd. This account of St. Ursula's legend is the longest, most complicated version of the story. Shorter accounts have everyone die as soon as they land on the continent from Britannia, having been blown off course by a storm. Some identify Ursula as a daughter of the Romano-British king Dionotus, ruler of Dumnoia, the West Country in England. Dionotus was commanded to supply wives for the newly settled Armorica, modern-day Brittany, from the ruler Conan Meriadec. Dionotus sends Ursula to be Conan's wife and 11,000 virgins as tributes for Conan's men. They never make it to Brittany because a storm blows their ships off course, they land on the continent and are slaughtered by the Huns. Ursula's legend and that of her entourage don't end with their deaths. In the centuries after her story was recorded in the Golden Legend, she inspired a cult of virgins in Germany and an order of nuns who were scandalized by tales of witchcraft. The Golden Legends version of St. Ursula's story formed around two archaeological sources. The first is a stone inscription from around the year 400 in Cologne, now the site of the St. Ursula Church. The inscription commemorates the restoration of the building by a Roman senator named Clematius. This was at the site of the martyrdom of some unnamed and unnumbered holy virgins. The second source is the discovery in the 12th century of the skeletal remains of hundreds of bodies, also in Cologne. These were taken as physical proof of the Ursula legend, the bodies of Ursula and her entourage. We now know the skeletons aren't old enough to be the saint's remains. What was uncovered was likely the graveyard of some forgotten Germanic tribe. There's no mention of the name Ursula in any church martyrologies or documents until the 10th century. Gregory of Tours, a powerful Gallo-Roman historian and bishop from the 6th century, wrote about the Theban Legion. This was a legendary Roman company of 666 men who died as martyrs in modern-day Switzerland after they converted en masse to Christianity. There used to be a church in Cologne dedicated to the Theban Legion. Procopius, a Byzantine scholar and writer also from the 6th century, has another story that likely influenced the development of the Ursula legend. A British queen sails with 100,000 soldiers to the mouth of the Rhine to persuade the love of her life, Radagast, king of the Varni, to marry her. Historians believe both of these stories contributed to the development of the Ursula legend. An 8th century document discovered in Essen, Germany, is the first to establish a cult of virgin martyrs in the region. It mentions a woman named Marta and another Saula, no Ursula. 200 years later, around 922, a sermon also found in the same Rhine Valley region near Cologne recounts an historic event in which the relics of Saint Pinosa, the leader of a band of virgins, are to be moved from Essen to Cologne. When the bones arrive in Cologne, the name Ursula replaces Pinosa. No one knows why or how this happened, but once Pinosa's relics are translated to Cologne, then renamed Ursula, Cologne becomes the undisputed center for the Ursula legend, and Ursula becomes the undisputed leader of a virgin band. The former leaders, Marta, Saula, Pinosa, are now Ursula's followers. The administrative error or conscious doctoring of documents that rewrote several legends was a savvy political play to benefit Cologne over Essen. And it worked. Before we explore how Cologne benefited from Ursula's legend, let's discuss the 11,000 virgins. The first surviving passio naming Ursula as the leader of a band of virgins comes from the year 970, a few decades after she replaced Pinosa. But the number of virgin attendants is rarely quantified. Most stories mention a few or just a group or band. Some, however, list the number 11. How did the number 11 become 11,000? Well, as is the case with St. Lawrence's death, a misreading and typo are likely to blame. Accounts of the skeletons discovered in Cologne before the 9th century use two Latin terms to describe the bones of the alleged virgin victims. One is undecimilia, which means 11 years old. The remains of an 11-year-old girl named Ursula were found in the cemetery. This was misread and then mistranscribed as undecimila, which means 11,000. The other error is the misreading of a Latin abbreviation, XIMV. XI is the Roman numeral for 11. M and V stand for Martyres Virginum, or Virgin Martyrs. Read the abbreviation as XIMV, it means 11,000 virgins. Historians agree that a misreading or typo, possibly intentional, led to the number 11,000. By the time the Golden Legend was published, it was no longer questioned. We're now in the 10th century. Cologne is the center of a St. Ursula legend that now accommodates 11,000 virgin martyrs and at least 15,000 others. When their bones are allegedly discovered in a mass grave 200 years later, Ursula fever grips the Rhine Valley. Ursula's popularity was helped by an abbess and mystic named Elizabeth of Schönau. She was a celebrity in her time, known for prophetic visions and conversations with saints, even God. Monks from Cologne sent her boxes of virgin's bones, and also tituli, name cards created by the monks after visions revealing each of the virgin's names. Elizabeth Schönau confirmed the virgin's names and the authenticity of the bones. Naysayers who wanted to know why there were skeletons of children and men among the virgins were silenced when Elizabeth confirmed that these accompanied the virgins on their pilgrimage. St. Ursula's legend did not include anyone except virgins up until this point. The sudden appearance of hundreds of bones, holy relics authenticated by Elizabeth of Schönau, meant that pilgrims started flooding into Cologne. The small Church of the Holy Virgin was no longer an adequate space to house the ever-growing collection of relics and the throngs of tourists who came to see them. The church was expanded and renamed after St. Ursula. The most prized relics, the bones of Ursula herself, were kept in Cologne at the church. Others, including those of Cordula, were sent around the world to curry favor with kings, bishops, and other powerful men. These generous gifts were also great PR. Their presence in faraway parishes spread St. Ursula's legend and put Cologne on the religious pilgrimage map. By the 14th century, the economy of Cologne depended in a large part to the promotion of Ursula's cult. She was supremely important to this city to attract tourists and also as a protector. The Rhine Chronik, a late 13th century chronicle of the area, credits the miraculous appearance of St. Ursula that saved the city from a siege in 1265. Alongside the lucrative boom in tourism was a flourishing trade in Ursula souvenirs. Hundreds of reliquary busts of the 11,000 virgins were manufactured from around the year 1260 until the 14th century. These are really stunning works of art, wooden polychrome sculptures that are nearly life-sized, each one unique, representing one of the virgins with individual facial features, hairstyles, jewelry, and clothing in the latest 13th century fashions. Many of them feature the coats of arms of noble families, suggesting they were made for wealthy, powerful people. About 160 have survived, some of which are of men and maybe children as well. The majority are kept in the Goldene Kammer, or Golden Chamber, at the St. Ursula Church. This is a gorgeous chapel whose walls are decorated in geometric patterns made out of the bones. If you ever get a chance to go to Cologne, make time to see the Goldene Kammer. Joan A. Holliday's research suggests quite convincingly that the proliferation of these unusual busts is due to the growth of a St. Ursula cult in Cologne dedicated to Ursula and her 11,000 virgins. It's important to note that the vast majority of surviving reliquary busts through time are of male saints. These busts from the Rhine Valley nearly all depict women and were made for women. According to writer Erhard Weinheim in a 1607 piece, the sculptures were used in a St. Ursula procession. Carried by adolescent girls from the top families of the city, all dressed in gold, the busts were paraded around town and through the local cemetery before returning to the Goldene Kammer. This is likely an age-old tradition that began once the busts were made centuries earlier. While these beautiful reliquary busts were being mass-manufactured in the Rhine Valley, a religious lay movement of unmarried, virginal women devoted to a life of prayer and good works had coalesced in the same region in and around Cologne. These women, called beguines, didn't belong to any official religious order, but loosely organized themselves like a convent for a life of good works, preaching the word of the Christian Lord, and remaining virgins. Ursula and the 11,000 virgins were their model. The church and the local population initially accepted the beguines, even though the women's lives and religious beliefs and practices weren't regulated by any official church body. Archbishop Conrad placed the beguines under the supervision of the Dominican friars. Several groups of women then set up households near the Dominican cloister and the St. Ursula Church. More groups of unmarried virgins followed suit, with communes popping up all over the Rhine Valley region, leasing land from monasteries and convents. English chronicler Matthew Paris counted 2,000 beguines in the year 1243, half of which were in Cologne. These figures are likely exaggerated, but the presence of the beguines so changed Cologne that the Engasse, one of the streets bordering the Dominican cloister, became popularly known as Arta Platea Beguinarum, Latin for the narrow street of the beguines. Imagine how extraordinary this would be today. Now imagine what people in the 13th century must have thought about it. Hundreds of unmarried women living in communes, making their own decisions, running their households, preaching their personal views, without the supervision of or permission from men. A woman's existence at this time was to become a wife and a mother. The beguines refused to be either. There weren't 11,000 of them, but it was as if Ursula's entourage had survived the attack from the Huns nearly 1,000 years ago and were now all living in Cologne. Archbishop Conrad had been warning the heads of these female households since the beginning. Joan A. Holliday writes that he cautioned them to take a firmer charge over the virgins and prevent them from wandering about outside and striking up conversations, especially with men. The implication being, women without the influence of a man were likely destined to fall into a life of sin. Regulations to rein them in were soon passed. In 1307, Archbishop Heinrich von Wernerberg excommunicated the beguines. Around the same time, Pope Clement V issued decrees to make a more clear distinction between pious women like nuns and the heretical beguines. The beguines were now prevented from wearing clothing that resembled religious vestments, discussing the nature of God or the Trinity, having any ideas that contradicted Orthodox teaching, and they couldn't organize themselves in any way like a convent. By the end of the 14th century, the movement died out. Most of the information in this section of the podcast comes from Joan A. Holliday's research on St. Ursula and the beautiful wooden reliquaries made in her honor and in honor of the 11,000 virgins. It's a paper entitled Relics, Reliquaries, and Religious Women, Visualizing the Holy Virgins in Cologne. It's a fascinating read. As the 15th century began, beguines were no longer allowed by the church. Anyone wishing to live a religious life had to do so with an oath to an official monastic order. It wouldn't be until the 16th century that St. Ursula would have an entire order devoted just to her. In 1535, a former nun and mystic named Angela Merici founded the Company of St. Ursula in Brescia, Italy. She'd been inspired by visions to join the Third Order of St. Francis, but left them when her uncle died. According to legend, she lost her sight in 1524 whilst praying to a crucifix in Crete. Her eyesight was restored weeks later while praying to the same cross. She founded the Company of St. Ursula because she wanted to educate girls, future wives, and mothers for the betterment of family life through religion. This was quite revolutionary at a time when no one thought it necessary to educate women at all. St. Ursula, who's the protector of students and universities, was the obvious choice for a patron saint. In 1572, the Company of St. Ursula divided in two. The Ursulines, or the Order of St. Ursula, dedicated themselves to monastic life. The Angelines continued Angela Medici's secular work, educating girls. Both orders still exist today. In 1632, a series of demonic possessions was reported by a chapter of the Ursulines in Loudun, France. The convent had only been open for 6 years with 17 nuns, whose average age was 25. The possessions coincided with an outbreak of plague. Townsfolk isolated themselves and the nuns social distance from everyone by quarantining behind convent walls. After nearly half a year of lockdown, one of the nuns claimed she was visited by the spirit of a dead confessor. Other nuns soon reported seeing apparitions of dead people they knew. The convent chaplain, Jean Mignon, decided an exorcism was in order, although most townspeople thought the nuns were just making it up. When questioned, the nuns claimed the demon Asmodeus was behind the visions and had been sent to the convent to commit evil and impudent acts with them. They also accused a priest and several prominent townsfolk of being in league with Asmodeus and the devil. Finally, they accused a man named Grandier as the magician responsible for everything, summoning Asmodeus, bewitching others, and plaguing the nuns with visions of dead people. On June 23, 1634, Grandier stood trial for making a pact with the devil and presiding over a witch's Sabbath. Grandier was found guilty. Here is a translated excerpt from the court records.
"We have ordered and do order the said Urbain Grandier duly tried and convicted of the crime of magic, maleficia, and of causing demoniacal possession of several Ursuline nuns of this town of Loudun, for atonement of which we have condemned and do condemn the said Grandier to make amend honourable, his head bare, a rope round his neck, holding in his hand a burning taper weighing 2 pounds, before the principal door of the church of St. Pierre du Marche, and before that of St. Ursula of this town, there on his knees to ask pardon of God, the King, and the law. This done, he is to be taken to the public square of St. Croix and fastened to a stake on a scaffold, which shall be erected on the said place for this purpose, and there to be burned alive and his ashes scattered to the wind."
Grandier was executed for practicing magic. It's thought, however, that he was a scapegoat, the entire affair made up by Cardinal Richelieu, a hugely influential and powerful statesman credited for strengthening the monarchy in France against local feudal lords and Habsburg Empire. Grandier fell foul of the cardinal over a book he wrote that criticized the government, and he died because of it. Other theories attribute the nuns' visions to hysteric episodes, not unlike the witch trials in Salem, Massachusetts a few decades later, which saw women living in a highly repressed and sexist society express themselves in the guise of fits. They could speak their minds when they were possessed. Aldous Huxley, author of the novel Brave New World, wrote a non-fiction book about the possessions entitled The Devils of Loudun. Huxley believed that the nuns were obsessed with Grandier, who had the reputation of being very handsome and whose sexual exploits were well known. The possessions and subsequent accusation were, according to Huxley, the result of jealousy after Grandier declined an invitation from the Mother Superior to become the director of the convent. There are 2 books, including Huxley's, about the Loudun possessions, as well as an opera, a play, a song, and 2 films. The 1970s Ken Russell film The Devils, based on Huxley's book, stars Vanessa Redgrave as an abbess deformed by scoliosis and Oliver Reed as Grandier. It was and is a very controversial film, blasted by critics for being outrageous and pornographic. Film critic Roger Ebert gave it a 0-star rating. Despite the almost universal panning, however, The Devils has become a cult classic. I quite like the film, but make sure you read up on it or watch a trailer or two before watching. The film is definitely not everyone's cup of tea. In art, St. Ursula is depicted with an arrow in her torso or neck. Sometimes she holds the arrow that killed her, along with a banner. Many paintings show the other virgins as well. Not 11,000 of them, but enough to give the impression of a large company of women. And there's usually a ship. Medieval depictions are quite gruesome displays of death. The Huns always shown wearing Eastern clothing, looking like Persians, Germanic tribesmen, or Turks. My favorite artwork is a series of 9 paintings created by Vittore Carpaccio in the 1490s. Each shows a moment in the legend, and they're huge, almost as tall as the walls of the Galleria dell'Accademia in Venice, where they've recently been restored. Another great work is by Caravaggio, likely his last work before he was murdered. Head to the same podcast website or social media feeds to see the paintings. There's a prayer that the faithful recite to entreat the protection from St. Ursula and her 11,000 companions. The golden legend has an origin story for the prayer. In the 12th century, there lived a German monk who was devoted to virgin martyrs. One night, while gripped by a terrible fit of illness, the monk has a vision in which an endless parade of holy virgins passes in front of him. The most beautiful virgin pauses. She asks the cleric if he recognizes her. He confesses to his embarrassment that he doesn't. The virgin reveals she's one of Ursula's 11,000 companions and tells him that if he were to recite the Paternoster 11,000 times, all the virgins will protect him forever. The Paternoster is the Lord's Prayer, the one that begins, "Our Father, who art in heaven." When the monk awakens, he tells his brothers to spread the word about this prayer, then begins praying. As he utters the last lines of the 11,000th Paternoster, 11,000 virgins appear and escort the monk to heaven. About 200 years later, the origin story appeared in an altered form in an English manuscript called the Shropshire Miracle. The setting of the story moves from Germany to England, making a hermit named John of Warwick the recipient of the beautiful virgin's instructions. This English version of the prayer adds to the 11,000 Paternosters an additional 11,000 Ave Marias, a sort of companion prayer that honors the Virgin Mary. In 1647, a dummy's guide of sorts was published to provide four ways to complete this seemingly endless series of prayers. Here they are, in case you want to have a try. 1. Recite 11 cycles of prayers daily for 1,000 days. A cycle is 11 Paternosters and 11 Ave Marias. 2. 30 cycles daily for a year, plus 50 cycles on St. Ursula's feast day. 3. 1,000 cycles daily for 11 days. And lastly, 3 cycles daily for 11 years. Anyone who completes the cycle, no matter the cadence chosen, will have the help of 11,000 virgins, a third of whom will intercede on behalf of the soul of the petitioner, a third to protect the petitioner from bodily harm, and a third to escort the soul to heaven upon death. The Shropshire Miracle also records a prophecy made by St. Ursula. She tells John of Warwick that it's the Jews that are preventing Christianity from spreading throughout the world, and she's going to fix this by converting all of them over the next 1,000 years. This works out to be the year 2440. Ursula also states that marriage may never be annulled or dissolved in any way ever. A man and a woman are married in the eyes of God the moment they make verbal oaths. Consummating the marriage, having sex, is unnecessary, discouraged actually. After these pronouncements, Ursula teaches the hermit a shorter prayer for St. Cordula, whom we met earlier, and another for a virgin named St. Jessiana. The Shropshire Miracle ends with a record of John of Warwick's journey to Langley in 1411, where a demon had disguised themselves as an angel to trick the townsfolk. When John arrives, the demon attempts to drown him. A voice from heaven stops the demon, who confesses to the deceptions and to the whereabouts of 30 bewitched villagers who are planning to attack the local church this very night. The voice reveals herself to be St. Ursula, who then commands John to find the possessed villagers and cure them with a secret sign. John does as he's told, then takes up Ursula's crusade to rid the world of heretics. Modern church authorities disavow the validity of the Shropshire Miracle. The revelations are extremely anachronistic, offensive, and like the rest of St. Ursula's legend, deemed a work of fiction. A 19th century German mystic named the Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich had visions of St. Ursula, who explained that she was guided by the archangel Raphael. The angel trained all the virgins in the art of war, not so they could survive the attack, but in order to remain virgins, unviolated by the Huns and therefore worthy of becoming warrior brides of Christ upon their deaths. Emmerich also gave a detailed description of what the virgins looked like.
The maidens wore short dresses descending a little below the knee. They were quite plain on the hips and had close-fitting bodies. Their feet were laced. Some had their hair uncovered and braided around the head, whilst others wore a sort of headdress with ends hanging behind.
In their exercises, they used light, blunt spears.
In Emmerich's vision, no men accompanied Ursula and her entourage. St. Ursula has given her name to several locations around the world. You might not know that the Virgin Islands are named after Ursula and her 11,000 virgins, not the Virgin Mary. Ursula's feast day on October 21st is a public holiday on the British Virgin Islands. It involves an annual boat race. Cape Virgenes in Argentina and Las Virgenes Canyon near Malibu in California are also named after Ursula's virgins. And lastly, St. Mary Axe, a street in central London where the Gurkha now stands, is named after a church that used to be there, built in honor of the Virgin Mary and Ursula. The axe in the name is a reference to a relic once housed in the church, allegedly one of the axes wielded by a Hun to slay virgins. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of St. Podcast, St. Ursula, the leader of 11,000 virgins. Although her legend is likely fictional, there's no denying the effect she's had on the economy of an entire region and how she has inspired women since the 13th century. There's so much more to say about St. Ursula, we just didn't have time to cover it all in this episode. I'll be giving an illustrated Zoom lecture for our friends at Morbid Anatomy, which will expand on St. Ursula's effect over the women who worshipped her and how the men around them sought to rein them in. Head to morbidanatomy.org/events for more information. There's also a link to the event on the St. Podcast website and social media pages. If you're a fan of St. Podcast, you'll definitely find articles, talks, and classes at Morbid Anatomy that you'll love just as much. The readings in this episode were provided by Angela Crocombe and an Australian magpie singing in the background. The piano interludes were composed and performed by Amy Vanacore. Head to St. Podcast's website and social media pages to see images of the people, artworks, objects, and topics covered. Now that we're more than halfway through the current series on martyrs, we'd love to find out which saints you'd like to know more about as we put together the theme for the next St. Podcast series. Please email us with your thoughts and suggestions at feedback@saintpodcast.com. That's saint spelled out, S-A-I-N-T. Next up is the story of a martyred queen who is said to have been one of the greatest minds of the ancient world. She was born in Egypt and is the patron saint of unmarried women, girls, knife sharpeners, milliners, potters, and dying people. The saint has a firework named after her, and after her death, she married Jesus Christ. Tune in next time for the story of Saint Catherine, the Bride of Christ.